Who has four thumbs and is great at distractions?
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied.
And now, here are your hosts, Aaron Dicer and Jeremy Scott.
Promise me you won't freak out.
How can I promise you if I don't know what's going to happen?
Well, I guess you'll just have to trust me.
Why would I trust you?
Because if you don't, you're going to die in this closet.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 91 of Recotopia. My name is Jeremy Scott.
And I'm Dicer.
And this week's big recommend is the animated film Nimona from Netflix. Mm-hmm. It's a Netflix original. We like to say a shout out to the chat, those of you who are watching along and talking along with us, predicting my small recommends this week, like people who know me and shit. thank you for tuning in, even on this weird day and time. We appreciate you. Aaron, do you have any small recommends this week?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty little expense.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. A couple more awards wanters coming before my eyes.
Oh, yes.
We'll start with a courtroom drama, a couple courtroom dramas we'll talk about today. But this one's called Anatomy of a Fall. And this is, at its essence, the story of a woman whose husband takes a fall from their home and is now in court for his murder and whether or not he was murdered or not.
Interesting.
And that is the gist of what's going on here. Now, one of the interesting things about this movie, among many interesting things, I love this movie, by the way, is that it's in the French court system. So all that procedure you're used to with your courtroom dramas where now it's the defense's turn to talk and now it's the, person on the stand's turn to talk. Now it's the judge's turn to talk. That all goes out the window. They have conversations and anybody can pipe in at any time as part of these procedures. So that I found really fascinating, really interesting. It also really plays into the themes of the movie about how truth is understood, how narratives are decided, what you believe. I will say, I think this movie is best entered into without prepping yourself for, the big question of, guilty or not guilty. I think the mindset, that's going to happen naturally. Mm. I think this is a movie that is much better experienced just as a story. And then as the court thing develops, start to let your brain follow what you believe, what you don't believe. Coming out of it, you're going to have those conversations with the people you saw it with other people who've seen the movie. But it's such a beautiful film otherwise. It doesn't need that hook to really grasp you. So really interesting stuff here. Another reminder that the human mind is malleable and that our perspective on things, it is very arrogant of us to say our perspective on things is the truth, because that is so hard to define when it comes to especially relationships, domestic relationships specifically. There are moments out of all of our lives that could be taken out of context and people go, oh, you're a terrible person. I see. And this movie kind of deals with that in a little bit. So, Anatomy of Fall is really, really good and highly recommended.
You can find a lot of those moments for me in high school.
Yes.
My first small recommend is a 2023 film, The Kane Mutiny Court Martial. This is the final directing outing, I guess, for William Friedkin, mm-hmm. who also wrote the script. This is much like the movie The Kane Mutiny with Humphrey Bogart, based on a stage play, based on a book. So this is all the same source material. Whereas the Kane Mutiny film spends most of its time on the boat showing you events of the mutiny. The Kane Mutiny Court-Martial that just came out this year is all courtroom. It's only interested in the court-martial proceedings after the fact. A lot of the same, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Kane Mutiny, but a lot of the same events that happen in that story on the boat are referred to in this court-martial. The Kane Mutiny itself does end with the court-martial, but it's not the bulk of the movie the way this is. This gives 4 or 5 actors some really good stuff to chew on with really long takes. Jason Clark is kind of our main character. He's playing Greenwald. He's the defense attorney. He's reluctant. We have Kiefer Sutherland playing Queeg. That's the captain of the Kane, who was basically mutinied against, is the charge. Jake Lacy is playing Merrick, the guy who overthrew the captain. And then Monica Raymond, who I know from the TV show Hightown, is playing the defense attorney. I'm sorry, I said Greenwald was the defense. No, he's the defense attorney. She's playing the prosecutor. Sorry, it's convoluted because the trial is not about the captain. It's about the naval officer who overthrew the captain. Kiefer Sutherland almost steals this movie straight to hell. I have never seen Kiefer like this. He is subdued and yet full of rage. He's doing a vocal delivery tick thing. And I really don't want to say too much about how this all plays out. I don't think much of it will be surprising, especially if you've seen the Kane Mutiny, but a good courtroom drama, it's not necessarily about figuring out what happened. Just like with A Few Good Men, you know what happened. It's about how do we get to the conclusion. And there is a scene at the end of this movie that I did not see coming that knocked me off my feet and made the movie a 10 for me. Great acting. Lance Reddick is in this, one of his last performances. He's one of the military judges. Lewis Pullman is in this, and Jay Duplass is in this. Just a really, really good cast, solid acting. William Friedkin went out with a home run.
Yeah, it's really, really good. I it's not often anymore that you will see a courtroom drama movie that is literally all in the courtroom.
Right.
Like, it's, you know, you're always getting flashbacks and, you know, setups. And, you know, by about a half hour into this movie, your brain just goes, oh, I'm not getting that stuff. I'm just sitting here in the courtroom with these people. And you just kind of lock into what the movie is. Now, I mean, there's a very brief prologue in the hallway, and then there's a, you know, epilogue as well, again, that's really good, but it's for the vast majority and the entirety of the middle just the process of this court. And not only that, it's in chronological procession.
Yes.
Like you're literally experiencing this you know, court case with all the like recesses, you know, edited out. So it's, to be able to do that and be as captivating and compelling as this movie manages to do is a combination of the captivating and compelling performances, specifically Jason Clark, Kiefer Sutherland, and Lance Reddick, I think would be the primary ones that I would give credit to. And yeah, it's really, really good.
I'm so glad you liked it. And I should have said this earlier. This is on Showtime if you guys want to check that out. And that means if you have a premium subscription at one of your other streamers, a very good chance Showtime is part of that package. So
yes, and Paramount Plus has all the Showtime stuff now too. So
excellent. Aaron, do you have a second small recommend?
I do. This one is just out on Netflix, I believe. It's called Naiad. Annette Bening and Jodie Foster coming together to tell the story of a woman who was a distance swimmer. And in this case, this means open water swims. Her thing was, can you swim from, you know, the Bahamas to Florida? Or can you swim, you know, whatever? And her big, you know, Moby Dick white whale was to swim from Cuba to Florida. And to do so unassisted, open water swim. Now, unassisted doesn't mean there isn't a boat around or anything like that. It means nobody can touch her. Nobody can, you know, drag her along. they can feed her. They can like squeeze food, you know, through a tube or whatever. But it's an unassisted swim as far as the energy exertion to make it that far. So the interesting part about this and the interesting part of this story, this true story, is that this was attempted by this woman at the age of 28. And then several decades later, she was like, and failed. Several decades later, she was like, you know what? I'm going to try that again now that I got my mind in a better, like my mind is so much stronger now as an older human being than it was when I was in my 20s. My body isn't as strong, but I think the mind is the part that's going to do it. So very interesting story, very inspirational. The movie itself isn't a 10 for me. I think the movie has some issues with the way that it centers its story on her background and her life. I think there's some important stuff there, but the way the movie integrates it is a little befuddling to me. I didn't quite understand it. It didn't have the impact that I felt like it should have. But the core of the story was interesting enough for me to really enjoy this and give it a recommend. So it's called Naiad. And both Annette Bening and Jodie Foster are amazing in this. They're really good. So not to be surprised.
I'm not surprised that they're really good. My wife was looking at this one the other day, thinking about watching it. And I just... You know, I don't want anything to do with that kind of activity.
What, watching the movie?
No,
or swimming?
Swimming in the open ocean from one place of land to another place of land. I don't even like swimming away from the beach and then back to the beach.
Oh, interesting. So there'd be a lot of anxiety in this movie for someone who deals with like putting themselves in the, yeah.
Okay. Probably. I mean, yeah. I went out on a fishing boat in the Gulf of Mexico to where we couldn't see the shore anymore, and that scared the bejesus out of me. And I wasn't in the water. But yeah, there would be some Kids in the Cave rescue levels of anxiety for me, I'm sure, for some of this, but that might heighten the experience. Might make it more fun. All right, my second small recommend. I need to stop talking about this shit on Twitter so that people know coming into the show that I'm going to recommend Blue Eye Samurai on Netflix. I am now 6 episodes in. There are only 8. I will be finishing this tonight, hell or high water. I only watched this. This is very similar to the reason I watched Franklin Rich's Artifice Girl, is that a key 3 or 4 people that I follow on Twitter all talked about this on the same day. And I thought, I'm going to check that out. Sounds like nothing I've ever seen. This is like nothing I've ever seen. Maybe I'm not watching the right content. It is in a category of anime, but people are saying it's not technically anime. I'm not trying to get involved in those debates. Stylistically, tonally, combining emotion and emotional character arcs with some of the most visceral, violent shit I've ever seen. The music choices, the voice work, the animation is among some of the most gorgeous animation I have ever watched in any kind of TV show or movie. You're slightly nodding. Have you watched any of this?
I watched the first episode, yes.
Okay. And you didn't hate it since you're slightly nodding, right?
You want to know now?
Oh, sure. You just liked it?
No, I loved it.
Okay, great.
I thought it was amazing. I'm very excited to see the rest of the series. I think you oversold the violence a little bit. I don't really think it's all that violent, at least
keep
in the
watching.
First episode. I guess maybe I've just seen a lot more stuff that's, you know, specifically violent in the case of animation. But yeah, it doesn't shock me yet.
Okay, well, yeah, it just keeps getting deeper and better and more resonant. The 5th episode, which I watched last night, is one of the best episodes of any show I've seen in 5-10 years. The themes are really starting to tie together, I just can't wait to see where it goes. They apparently have a plan for 4 years, if enough of you watch this along with me, to make it something Netflix renews. Yeah, just blew me out of the water in every possible way. Go get in the fastest computer you have and drive to Netflix.com and consume.
I loved it. I think there the thing I love the most about it, and I imagine this will continue, is that it is adult animation. And I mean that in the sense of it is made for adults. And so it does not fear adult subject matter. It does not fear nudity. It does not fear violence, you know. But what I like about it is that also isn't excessive or it's not superfluous. The things that use the nudity it has or the violence or the language or whatever all really feels authentic to what's going on as well as purposeful for the story. So there's there's really, I think there's a really good sense of what to include for what this story needs. Now, I've only seen the first episode, so I'm speaking, you know, with 1/8 of the knowledge of this show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot still to happen. But that was my perception after the first episode, was just great storytelling. Just it yep. totally knows and has the freedom to use what it needs to use to tell the story.
The official description is a master of the sword lives life in disguise while seeking revenge in Endo period Japan. All right, let's move on to the big recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
This week's big recommend is from Netflix, and it is Nimona, a movie that was originally basically going to be killed until it was revived and brought to Netflix. And thank God Netflix revived and brought this movie over. Mm-hmm. Let's dive in. Nimona starts with a visually interesting history of the kingdom, which has been attacked by a monster, an evil monster that lived outside the city and attacked with no warning. But a hero named Glorith arose and banished the monster back to whence it came, and then began training an elite force of knights to protect the kingdom for all of time. All right, that's the setup. And then we, bam, jump forward 1,000 years. So if you thought this was a medieval story, you're wrong. There's internet, there's flashy screens, there's flying cars. It's a really delightful mix of eras, because there's also like castle-type buildings and citadel-type infrastructure, and it's just a nice little mishmash of eras. Because we're not really in a real place with real time or anything like that. But we open with a knighting ceremony. And this year, for the first time, they're going to knight someone who is not pure blood. He's just a commoner. But he has the heart, and he's worked all his life, and his name is Ballister. And he's going to get knighted alongside his friend, Golden Loin. One of the best names ever in an animated movie. Golden Loin is a noble-born, direct descendant of Glorith, who had saved the city 1,000 years before. Before the ceremony, we get a nice little scene where we see that these two men, Golden Loin and Ballister, are in love. And I appreciate that the movie doesn't give us a lot of, hey, look at this. Hey, look at this. Pay attention to this. It's just normal. It's just normal. Nowhere and anywhere in this movie does anyone act that it's weird that they love each other. And I just appreciate that. Okay. They go down for the knighting ceremony. Golden Loin goes first because he's the golden boy. And then Ballister gets knighted. And after he gets knighted, he's holding his sword with the handle facing the queen, and the sword opens and emits a green laser, which blasts the queen and causes the scoreboard thing to fall on the stage. Everyone thinks Ballister just assassinated the queen, and he escapes under the arena as everyone yells to get him. Then we meet Nimona, who is doing some graffiti, and she's a bit of a rebel street child looking for a criminal mentor. And she sees a news report about Ballister and realizes he is perfect. The movie will completely gloss over how she finds him when no one else can. I don't really care. But she shows up at his hiding spot where he is, you know, trying to plan how he can clear his name. In the fracas, when the queen was killed, Golden Loin chopped off Ballister's right arm. So now he has a Luke Skywalker thing going on with his right arm. And she says, hey, I'm your new sidekick. And he's like, no, you're not. And so he ditches her to go looking for Golden Loin to try and explain himself and is promptly arrested and thrown in jail. He's visited that evening by the night director, the director of the Institute, who basically says how disappointed she is in him and how she should never have trusted him or listened to the Queen in saying that Ballister should have been knighted. Then Nimona shows up and rescues him because she's a shapeshifter. And she turns into a rhino as well as several other animals to help him defeat the knights and get out of the Institute and back to the hideout. And this is also recreating what she had doodled earlier the first time that we see her with Ballister. When he comes to, he realizes that Nimona is a shapeshifter and is initially scared and calls her a monster, which she is not really very happy to hear. And this is sort of the first hint. This was my second time through this movie. This is sort of the first hint, I think, the movie gives you for what it's got in store for you. But you just don't process it as that at the time. Because it's pretty sly and you're not really expecting necessarily, I want, where this goes. But he realizes he needs her help. So they make an official deal that he will make her his sidekick once she helps clear his name. They're trying to get to the steward, I forget what he's called, but the kid who works in the night room and handed everybody their swords, because Ballister realizes that wasn't my sword that killed the Queen. So the boy that handed me the sword, Squire, that's his name. I knew there was a name for him. So they decide they need to talk to the Squire. That requires getting on the subway. In order to get on the subway, Nimona takes Ballister's form to distract all the knights, and it's a pretty humorous scene as she starts saying, I'm a terrible murderer, and all the stuff that, you know, the whole point here is to try and prove the opposite. But when the subway stops at the next station, all the knights are there. So, and they storm the subway, but Ballister and Nimona had escaped through the roof. They get to the market. Again, the knights show up. They find the squire. And another hilarious moment where Nimona turns into this little street urchin boy slash demon that ultimately ends up terrifying the squire. But they get the squire, they put him in a trunk, steal a car, and then take off. And this is when the squire is able to show them video he has. And there is a brief moment early in the movie where he tries to show video to Ballister, but everybody thinks he's trying to take a selfie. And in the video, we see that it was the director, bum, 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 who swapped out Ballister's sword. And so now Ballister has proof that he was set up. Ballister, at this point, it's worth noting, still believes in the Institute, and Nimona is shocked by it. But they go to the Institute with their proof. He holds up the phone for all of maybe 2 seconds before it gets shot out of his hand and destroyed. Bye-bye proof. There's a huge fight in which Nimona is again hilarious, turning into an ostrich at one point and running alongside a curved wall of knights. She eventually becomes a dragon and then sees a little kid that's terrified of her and shrinks down to little kid to say, no, it's okay. And the little kid calls her a monster. And then Ballister shows up on some kind of air motorcycle, grabs Nimona, and they take off. Golden Loin, whose first name is Ambrosius, it's the first time it shows up in my notes here, but he goes to confront the director about the Queen's death. And she admits it, and then she stabs him. But it's not actually him. It's Nimona, who does a super dramatic death. And then Ballister walks in saying, ha-ha, now I have proof again. And they upload video of the director's confession to a whole realm can see it, and they do. And there's a cute little scene where Ballister and Nimona celebrate by dancing. But then the director, ever clever, decides to explain it away by saying it wasn't her in the confession. It was Nimona, a shape-shifting monster among them. She has pulled a scroll from the 1,000-year-old archive that has a picture of a monster of fire with a little girl that looks like Nimona in it. And that is enough to basically get everybody off of her back. Golden Loin messages Ballister privately about nachos. Turns out they have a favorite spot to go get nachos. I personally don't recommend getting nachos at a dive bar, but you do you. And there's this awesome moment here where Golden Loin is like, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry about everything, about your arm. She manipulated you. She manipulated me. She manipulated all of us. And Ballister thinks, oh, he's on our side now. But it turns out Goldeloy is actually talking about Nimona.
Some of the best pronoun gaming in the history of film. It's so good.
It's incredible. It's incredible because it's intentional.
Yes, it's so good. That's what it's supposed to be for.
Yes. And so he shows Ballister the scroll ultimately and says, look, she's the monster that Glorith defeated. Like, she's been here all along. She's not one of us. So Ballister goes to Nimona, and before she can really say anything, he interrogates her, basically calls her a monster, basically stops short and says, you know what you are. And she is crushed. This is the first person in maybe even 1,000 years that has shown her any kind of acceptance. And she's just distraught. She runs out of the city. And of course, the people in the city believe there's a monster out there, and they never go out there. She finds a well, and that triggers a wonderful scene that's mostly dialogue-free of flashing back to Nimona and her early years as she tries to fit in by becoming the animals and creatures she sees around her, little bird, a little fish, a deer, and they all reject her. They all think she is not one of them. And then she sees a little girl, and so she turns into a little girl. And lo and behold, they meet and become fast friends, and they play and dance and laugh. And then there is one moment where they're frolicking, and Nimona turns into a little bird and gets an apple, and then comes back and turns down back into a little girl. And the blonde girl is a little nervous, but then kind of realizes this is kind of cool. This is kind of fun. So we see them playing and frolicking and wrestling when Nimona is in various forms, and they end up doing this right by the village the little girl is from. The adults in the village see Nimona as a monster and literally start attacking and beating her. One guy has a flaming log that bounces, flips back into the village, and starts a fire that burns the whole village down. As the adults run away, the little girl lingers, and Nimona says, Glorith? And that's when we realize, well, I realized it was Glorith pretty quick, but that's when most people realize, I'm not trying to brag, but it was a fun experience with my wife, because I said, you know that's Glorith, right? And she was like, what? And then like a minute and a half later, she was like, you were right. But this is where we find out this is Glorith. Glorith says to Nimona, go back to from whence you came, which is the famous quote. And this is where we realize that the mythology of the monster and Glorith has been warped over time, maybe even from the beginning of the time that it was told. And the movie has a lot to say about how history works. And even when it's written, it's not always correct. This movie is asking so many big questions, and that's part of why I love it. So now Glorith, now Nimona realizes that this is it. This is it. I'm done. She turns into this giant black streaky grief monster and heads toward town. The people of the town, the knights, they try to defend themselves. They shoot missiles at her. She screams as though it's hurting her, but nothing's really slowing her down. And somewhere in this chaos, Ballister says, what have I done? As he realizes that he helped perpetuate the situation. And she nears the Glorith statue, which is multiple stories high, and has Glorith with a sword outstretched. And we hear a line of dialogue that Nimona had said earlier in the movie about, I don't know what's worse, that everyone here wants to run a sword through me, or that sometimes I just want to let them. And I had to stop the movie the second time through, because the first time through, I did not recognize this as I should have. This is a suicide attempt. Like, she's trying to end her life. That is the point she's come to. And she's stopped. Something is stopping her from throwing herself on the sword, and she looks down, and it's Ballister. And he says, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And then he says the key words of the whole movie. I see you, Nimona. And she shrinks down to her normal self and they embrace, and I cry both times I've watched this. This is where the tears happen for me. But the director, well, she's not done. She's not ready to give up. She's too power hungry. She's also governed completely by fear. So she points the cannons on the wall intended to shoot out at monsters into the city. And she's even warned. And this rung in my bell for several minutes because somebody says to her, that will destroy half the city. Innocent people will die. And she said, so will the monster. And I don't want to get into current global, but man, that statement holds so much weight. And she goes to fire the cannon and Nimona says, basically, I got this. Turns into a form we have not seen, a pink ethereal phoenix looking thing, and zip flies over to the cannon and makes impact just as the cannon fires, and everything is obliterated. There's a big hole in the wall. Everybody can now see it's just beautiful nature out there, no monsters. There are little pink falling particles that appear to symbolize the bits of Nimona falling back to Earth and that she had been destroyed. And we get a little bit of the town picking itself back up. We get to see Ballister and Golden Loin walking around openly holding hands and very happy together. And at some point, Bal goes back to his old hideout and starts kind of cleaning up and making it look nice. And he hears a knock at the door. And he goes, and there's no one there. And then we see a pink glow behind him, and we hear, hey, boss, which is her frequent phrase. And he turns around and says, holy shit. And then we go to credits. And it's a nice little Iron Giant of an ending there. I have lots of speculative fun wondering what form she is in there at the end of the movie when he sees her and claims that. But let's turn to Aaron and get his thoughts this time through in a moment.
Maybe we'll find out in the sequel, Jeremy.
You believe it's a definite?
I know. No, I don't. But you never know what Netflix might do with some of the stuff they have. Yeah, this movie is wonderful. So many of the ways that you already mentioned. One of the ways that that we haven't hit on a lot that I really love about this movie is how funny it is. I think there's something so beautiful and hilarious about Chloe Grace Moretz's performance is Nimona. It's so good. There are just all these moments. Everything feels like this Nimona character is both the consciousness that has been around for long enough to feel the weight of things, as well as also a child. Like both things are true in this, you know, this entity. This consciousness, and I think that's really tough to pull off. The other thing that's really tough for this movie to pull off, and you touched on it a little bit, but the story work that this movie is doing is actually really impressive. And what I mean by that is this isn't one of those movies where everything is as it seems until, oh, a twist. This is one of those movies where it is leading you through a labyrinth of reveals. And it's one of the reasons that I highly recommend with certain movies, even more than normal, to go in as blind as possible, is when a movie is so good at giving you the information it wants you to have when it wants you to have it. And this movie is so good at that. When we find out she's a shapeshifter is the perfect time for us to find out that she's a shapeshifter.
Yep.
When we find out about Glorith, it's the perfect time for us to find out about her previous relationship with Glorith. When we, you know, find out about the different machinations of the proving, disproving, you know, stuff, all of that stuff, the pronoun gaming that we already mentioned, another perfect story reveal where in, you know, most movies, it's the time where the person comes along and finally comes to the side of righteousness. And in this case, that's what we're being led to believe, but it's actually so much more painful than that. And I just think this movie subverts a lot of our expectations in really, really beautiful ways. Another example of that is they are in the subway. This is shortly after they met, and she goes into a backstory. telling of, you know, wishing at a wishing well.
Yeah.
The subway is going by these tiled walls, and the tiled walls turn into a different kind of animation. We've seen this thing in like Prince of Egypt, right? Yep. Where it's like, it's time for some of the backstory. So now we're doing the hieroglyphics on the walls are going to tell us the backstory. Other animated films have done this exact same thing. And it turns that expectation of actual backstory into an ending where Nimona's like, no, did you really think that was, you know, something? So like it completely subverts it. Now it also introduces a little bit of truth. There's just a little element of truth with the well, and the meeting was at a well, and yep. You know, so like there's these beautiful things that the storytelling is doing that I have a lot of respect for, mm-hmm. and it pays off. It all pays off so really, really well. I have a lot of lines eventually that we can talk about that just make me smile, make me laugh. But before mentioning those, I think it's worth mentioning Beck Bennett, as kind of the, you know, the dumb guy, the dumb knight, who is just so funny in this and is always wondering when the whale's going to come back, and stuff like that. Subtle little background things, like there's a background announcement that says something like, if you see something, slay something, which yes. I thought was really, really funny and clever and just subtle and kind of in the background. Another subtle thing in the background that is a little more meaningful, a little less funny, is, you know, this whole thing is happening where they're opening up the guard to anyone. It can be anyone. Doesn't have to be, you know, somebody in the line from Galorith, those kind of things. And then what happens. And then shortly thereafter, you're going by the billboard that's trumpeting this idea, and they're literally whitewashing it. They are literally whitewashing the billboard of all this diversity. And look, there is a line between being meaningful and being preachy. And I'm not saying this movie doesn't walk up to that line, but I do not think it crosses it. I think this movie beautifully stays on the side of being meaningful, metaphorical, letting the audience, you know, understand the symbolism, the themes that are going on here. I think it's all handled really, really well. But yeah, I have other things I can talk about, but I've talked a while. So Jeremy, hit me with some other stuff.
I mean, I think one of my favorite things about this movie is that I think what they did was they found a story that just naturally spoke to so many different things. Like, this movie could easily have said, all right, we're going to take the othering, right? The gender identity stuff about Nimona. We're going to make that the central theme and symbolism of this movie. But they didn't stop there. They gave us... They gave us government oppression. They gave us how history is altered via retellings. They gave us...
But I think it's all the same themes. They're not disconnected.
Yes, I know. I agree. But they can go in so many different directions. Like, there was a moment in this viewing where I was like, huh, this movie's about the TSA. And I think I could probably make an argument that that's part of what the movie is nitpicking, even though it wasn't necessarily a specific target. But just this idea that we are often sold things to be afraid of.
Yes.
In order to keep us in line.
That is the theme. That is the overall theme. It's about heroes and villains and who creates the villains. Who gets to say what a villain is? And the power that you give someone when they can create a villain for you. And the idea of what are heroes and villains? And is that even a valid dichotomy to use as we look at, you know, other beings? Like, that's, yeah. You know, so like, it, yeah, all that stuff is there.
Yeah, I got McCarthyism out of this time through. Because there's a bit where she says, we're working with an enemy that could be anyone, your child, your best friend. Evil people have used that kind of rhetoric to target people for communism, people for being gay, people for being trans. Like, this has been going on for all of time.
Yes.
Which again,
here's the new enemy.
Yeah. The movie's point. Yeah. I love the line, they grow up thinking they can be a hero if they can drive a sword into anything different. That's part of Nimona's speech that I think ultimately turns Ballister into an ally.
It's the key paragraph. It's the key paragraph of the movie. Because yep. in that paragraph also includes the sometimes I just want to let him. That's at the end of that paragraph. And it's just, it's all right there in that sentence. And it's just beautifully delivered. And it's really powerful.
And she's right, especially with that society, but she's right about America too. You mentioned this earlier with Chloe Grace and her performance, but just the absolute joy Nimona has at breaking things, doing mischief, is hilariously endearing. It makes me laugh, but it makes me love her. And I think that is done largely in the voice work. And again, I didn't know until this viewing that was even her. I didn't. The only voice I knew the first time through was Riz Ahmed. I love the bit when they throw Ballister in jail and the guard goes, "Murderer," and then turns around and goes, "Want to get some lunch?" And the other guy goes, "Yeah, I love lunch." There's so much background stuff, like you mentioned, with the see something, slay something, that I think probably I would need 4 or 5 viewings to catch all of it. But I think that's all my notes.
There are a few lines I'll mention. One of the first moments we meet Nimona, she's talking to him about his arm, and she says, "Did they let you keep the old one?" And the in the animation on her face is so perfect and hilarious and good. And that was the moment I fell in love with that character. Was that, "Did they let you keep the old one?" I thought that was really, really good. Who has 4 thumbs and is great at distractions? Just amazing. Then let's go kill. Get him. Let's go get him. Was, I thought, really funny. And then the other one I had to mention was I forget what the Beck Bennett character calls the rhinoceros, like a horse with a horn or so. A fat unicorn, right? He calls it a fat unicorn. And he said, "You mean rhinoceros?" And he goes, "If I meant rhinoceros, I would have said rhinoceros." And just the way he delivers it is so perfect.
Who is the voice actor there?
Beck Bennett. He's on SNL. That's the only reason I know his name.
Oh, okay.
And he's good on SNL. He's really funny. But yeah, he's perfect for that character.
Yeah, and I love the repeated something, 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 we win.
Yes, that's good too.
Works well all 3 different times it's used.
The cel shading animation in this, we haven't talked a lot about it. I think it's really beautiful and reminded me a lot of like playing Wind Waker back in the day. I think cel shading can be a really great way to visualize animation, and I think it's done really well here. It's kind of a CG cel shaded, you know, combo thing that they're doing that I think works really well. And then I just also had to mention the shot. At the end where he's standing on the edge of Glorith's sword, putting his hand on it, and it cuts to a wide view, and you just get the sense of all that emotion in that shot. You know, he's just this tiny thing on the end of this sword, and there's this underlying message of it doesn't take a lot. It doesn't take this big thing. You can just be one person that says, "I see you," one person that says, "I love you," one person that says, "I accept you," and you don't know the power that you can have. And I think that wide shot communicates all of that really, really well. So I wanted to mention that too.
It's good stuff. All right. Well, the super secret double feature traditionally comes after the big recommend. And Aaron, did you do your homework and prep a super secret double feature?
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I really went back and forth on this, not because I entertained a lot of choices. I didn't. I only ever entertained one choice. I just went back and forth on the fact that it is way too much. The most obvious choice. So obvious, in fact, you already mentioned it. It has to be the Iron Giant. Nimona is the Iron Giant. Like these stories are saying very similar things in a very similar way and have almost identical outcomes. It is so much, in fact, I wouldn't blame you for calling it a copy of The Iron Giant, except you're wrong, but I wouldn't blame you. It is so similar that I just could not shake away from that being the super secret double feature. It's just too perfect.
Yeah, Iron Giant is an all-time top 10, top 15 for mm-hmm. me. I really get that sense at the end when she sacrifices herself to save everyone. And even after that, you know, like an Iron Giant, they have a statue of the giant. And at the end of Nimona, there's people making makeshift, you know, memorials. Even even the bully knight guy, it's like, I love Nimona now. So, yeah, excellent double feature pick. I cannot dispute. What are we watching next week, Aaron?
Let's revisit Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Every time we try and get into a happy place, we end up going back to the sad place.
This isn't a dark movie, is it?
It depends on how your love life is gone, Aaron.
Okay, fair enough. Try to find a happy one at some point. I don't know. There's something about the authenticity of the reality of our shared trauma that is really powerful. So that's probably why a lot of that stuff comes to the forefront for me. but it also feeds into my love of Jim Carrey and his work as an actor, Kate Winslet as well. So it has been too long since I've watched it, and a lot of times that can be a motivating factor too. I really want to check this out again and go deep. So,
well, listeners, viewers, that is on Peacock as of the date of this recording. And it's also on a service I don't think I've ever heard of. Lowercase I, Q, uppercase I, Y, uppercase I.
That does not sound like a real thing, Jeremy.
I kiwi. But yeah, Peacock is the place to go to get it for free, available to rent at all the other normal outlets and whatnot. Let's do a couple questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
Been a while. We got a couple more minutes. And then we'll get the rock out of here. Yeah. Questions. My document is long. Here we go. Who played against type the best?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Tom Hanks in Road to Perdition, because he's often, I hear about Hanks that he never plays, you know, against type, and it's just not true. He's played against type a couple times, but this is, I think, the most prominent and the most powerful one. So Road to Perdition, Tom Hanks is my answer. And the other answer I would throw out there is one that you wouldn't think of, because he played so well against type that it became his second type. And that is Leslie Nielsen in Airplane. He was a dramatic actor before Airplane and did parody so well that that became his second career.
He did parody so well by just doing dramatic acting.
Yes, like, exactly.
By not doing comedy acting. The chat is stealing the shit out of my answer, which is Robin Williams. I'm fascinated by his career, where he went 30-plus years as this manic comedic presence, and then at one point said, you know what, I'm gonna do dramas. I'm gonna do a bunch of dramas. I'm gonna start with Good Will Hunting. I'm gonna do 1 Hour Photo, where I'm creepy bad guy. I'm gonna do Final Cut, where I'm still kind of a creepy guy who's not bad, looking at people's memories. And it just opened up this whole new world, I guess. Awakenings I would throw into there too, where he had this whole other side, an ability to touch you in ways that weren't just to make you laugh. So I think that's probably my all-time favorite example of that.
Yep.
All right. Coppola, McTiernan, De Palma, and Kevin Costner are all working on long gestating passion projects. Which, if any, do you think will be good, and why?
I mean, that's a list. How am I supposed to say any of them won't be good? I'm not necessarily extremely excited for Francis Ford Coppola's next thing, but the others, I would be pumped to see what they've got going on.
Coppola sounds like the most ambitious movie ever made. Like I believe, like, when I first read about it, he was like, it's going to be about the human condition. Something like that.
Yeah. And but my answer would be De Palma. I just out of sheer curiosity, I would be excited
to see. Coppola, McTiernan, and De Palma are all really, really old.
Mm-hmm.
That's not working in their favor. But and that's the thing with these long gestating passion projects is that they are often, you know, hit or complete miss. There's very little in the middle. I'm worried about Costner. That's my answer, because Costner directing a Western is almost always a hit for me. He understands that genre really well, and he's had this idea for decades. My only concern is he's making a two-part movie.
I'm so done with it.
Going to release like 4 months apart from each other, and I'm just tired of that crap.
I'm going to take us down just a little bit of a rabbit trail to this rabbit trail, which is, as somebody who votes in Ward's body, I'm seriously considering the idea that I would find it objectionable for myself to vote for a half of a movie for any awards. Mm. I cannot see myself nominating the latest Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse movie for Best Animated Film, because it's not a movie, and I can't say it's a great movie because the themes that it's dealing with, it leaves completely open. I don't know what this movie is going to say about the things it's introducing. I don't know what this movie is going to do with the characters and the situation they're in. How am I supposed to give it an award? It's not a movie. It's a half movie. You can't ask me to watch half a movie and then nominate it for awards. Like, it's really frustrating.
Here's a conversation I've had about 5,000 times since that movie. Why are there thousands upon tens of thousands of spider people trying to make sure Miles's dad dies because we all have to have the trauma in order to be the spider? Now, I say that, and somebody says, oh, I'm sure in the next movie they'll take that back. And I'm like, fuck you. They didn't take it back in this movie. There is a narrative arc. There is a way to tell a story. Empire Strikes Back does this extremely well. That has a beginning, a middle, and an end where there is resolution, but still threads left hanging.
Infinity War does this. Infinity War is a complete movie. Like, it's, you can do it. It's just so annoying.
Yeah, I agree. That was a good rabbit hole, Aaron. I appreciate it. That's going to be where we end it today. Apologies in advance. There are no outtakes because Jeremy was late to the show. Again, thanks to the chat for coming out and correcting us when we need it and chiming in. And helping keep us on our toes. And next week, your homework is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
You're
on
welcome.
Peacock. For Aaron Dicer, this is Jeremy Scott, and I will see you next time.
See you guys.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Mind Mona.